The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you look at the 20 major metropolitan areas around the country, over the past 5 years, taxpayers have spent over $2 billion in civil settlements for police misconduct. $2 billion. It's an incredible number. Now, there are more misconduct settlements in rural areas and the suburbs of late, meaning there have been more police killings in the suburbs and rural areas than in some of these major metropolitan areas. So as large a number as that $2 billion is, it's astronomical across the country, and taxpayers are overwhelmingly paying it, because part of what happens, that $27 million doesn't deter it because police departments and police officers don't feel it. Due to qualified immunity, that leads to that settlement money being put onto the general fund's budget.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 2nd, 2021. The Derek Chauvin trial is underway in Minnesota, and the city of Minneapolis last week settled with the family of George Floyd for $27 million. Joining me in front of a live audience to talk about civil settlements in police misconduct cases is my Brookings colleague, Rashawn Ray, a sociologist who studies, among other things, police shootings. Ray is the author of a recent Lawfare article about how to reform the civil settlement system to make it more effective in deterring misconduct. He recommends a series of reforms which we discussed and about which he took questions from the audience. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 2nd, Rashawn Ray on reforming civil police settlements.
So first of all, Rashawn, I want to start with the Derek Chauvin trial, which is not directly related to the issue that you wrote about for Lawfare, but is so pervasively indirectly related that I thought it's a good place to start. How closely have you been following the trial, and what are your impressions of it so far?
So, I mean, I've been following the trial quite a bit. And first, Ben, thank you for having me on. Thanks to your team for working with me.
Thanks for coming.
As I act like either I'm 70 or 17, I'm not sure which one I was just now trying to figure this out. But yes, I mean, I've been following the trial quite a bit and have been commenting on it. I mean, I think for a lot of people who aren't familiar with criminal trials, some of the things that are happening seem out of whack, to just be blunt about it. But I mean, I found that it's been fairly consistent. I think there are definitely things on the prosecution side that people are questioning why they're doing it. And I think partly it's because they're trying to get out ahead of the defense and some of the things that they might do. But look, we see some of the normal tropes when it comes to a trial that oftentimes is so contentious around race. So we see, for example, George Floyd, particularly today and yesterday, trying to be painted as a career criminal, a career drug addict. Some of those things may or may not be true. The whole point of the prosecution is trying to get through that these things did not determine whether or not he lived or died. The defense is trying to argue that it did. We, of course, also saw the defense trying to paint some of the witnesses as being angry and intimidating. And, you know, it wasn't something that they were trying to hide, that they were clearly trying to paint certain types of witnesses who were standing there watching that as angry and aggressive and threatening, and others not so much. But I still think that the testimony that is really powerful, I think the EMT, I think her testimony is powerful. I also think just the number of sheer people who were there to witness it. You know, oftentimes we have incidents and there's one person. All they have to do is discredit one person.
Right.
They have to discredit tons of people. There's also a lot of law enforcement people who are also saying that this was something that was wrong and that it was not the type of standards that we would typically see.
So you've watched a bunch of these trials over the years, and there does seem to be a pattern in which, you know, the cop goes on trial, if he goes on trial at all, and the prosecution presents what seems to be a pretty compelling case that, you know, gosh, this force was really excessive and somebody died, or this was intentional excessive force and somebody died, i.e. murder. And then the jury acquits, or sometimes in the case of a grand jury, refuses to indict in the first place. Is your impression that this is the kind of overpowering case that will make that very difficult? Or are we setting up one of these situations where, you know, the people are led to expect a conviction by the way the press covers the trial, but the view from the jury box, for whatever reason, is quite different from that? I mean, obviously, we don't know what's going to happen, but...
Yeah, I mean, look, the things you lay out are the things that people worry about. And my pause was this. To your last point, yes, oftentimes court proceedings play out in public opinion. But as you know, when you're sitting in the jury box or when you're in the actual courtroom, the way that information is presented, the chronology of it, the discovery of it, what the judge allows to come in the courtroom is significantly different. Like, one big one that I thought swayed this case quite a bit is that the judge allowed for George Floyd's drug and criminal history to come in, or at least his arrest last year. But the judge did not allow Derek Chauvin's misconduct record to come into play. So one big thing that I didn't know, like I knew that he had nearly 20 roughly 20 misconduct allegations. I mean, people just have to realize how many that is. So for that not to come into play, and in particular, one where he held a teenager down in the same way, like these are the types of things where we see where judges have the ability to really influence the information that the jurors receive. And the way I think about it, as kind of a person who does this work and pays a lot of attention to this, if I didn't know that detail, I'm pretty sure most of the jurors do not know that detail either.
Right. And they're certainly not supposed to. And right. I mean, they're supposed to judge only based on what's presented in court. So to the extent that they may know it ambiently, that's considered a negative thing, not a positive thing.
Without a doubt. And So, you know, I think there are a lot of people nervous about how this case is going thus far. I tend to think that some of the biggest pieces of this include, first, the sheer number of people who witnessed it. I think that's a big thing. Again, it's not just one or two people. It's a lot. Because typically with these cases, it's only one or two. The other thing is you had medical experts on hand throughout the duration. The EMT, her testimony was really, really powerful. And then third, there are going to be police experts who are going to weigh in and say that they thought that this was not typical procedure by police officers. In other words, the key question they're going to be asked is, was the force used reasonable? Was there a reasonable standard to apply this level of force? And I think overwhelmingly, they're going to probably say no.
So let's talk about the piece you wrote for Lawfare, which is a deep dive on the problem of how municipalities settle police misconduct civil cases, and a set of proposals for how you might remediate that. So let's start with George Floyd, because it was the thing that caused me to ask you if you had any thoughts on the subject and wanted to write about it. George Floyd gets a $27 million settlement from the city of Minneapolis. And in the world of civil litigation, when you say, wow, a city's just going to pay out $27 million, that's a boatload of money. That surely got to deter future such misconduct. And your argument is not so fast, because the people who were paying and the people you're trying to deter are different people. So let's just start with, like, walk us through how $27 million doesn't deter Minneapolis cops from reckless behavior or malicious behavior with respect to citizens of the city.
Yeah, so this $27 million, it's a lot of money. It's the largest pretrial civilian payout for police misconduct, I believe, in American history. It's comparable, but even more than the $20 million in Prince George's County for the murder of William Green, officer currently getting ready to go on trial for that in Prince George's County. And then, of course, more than the $12 million that Breonna Taylor's family received, but not more than the $38 million that Corinne Gaines's family received, which is in Baltimore County.
Before you go on, those numbers seem kind of random to me. They're all big numbers. But when I think about Breonna Taylor, I mean, that was like practically a drive-by shooting. They just burst into her apartment and shot her. I'm not sure why she gets less than George Floyd, or, you know, do you have any sense of whether these numbers are just kind of random, or what, you know, kind of what the individual plaintiffs' lawyers are able to negotiate, or whether there's some rhyme or reason to it?
So a lot of it does have to do with how it's negotiated. Typically, the settlements I mentioned, and the reason for mentioning them, is they are significantly higher than others we've seen. For example, Tamir Rice, Laquan McDonald, a few Oscar Grant, Freddie Gray, those were all in the kind of $5 to $7 million range. Okay. These recent ones have been significantly more than that. Corinne Gaines is the reason why there was so much money, because $32 million was awarded to her son, who was also shot while his mother was holding him, and she was shot dead by the police. So $32 million of that $38 technically went specifically to him. The $6 went for her wrongful death, technically, which is in line with the other ones. The $12 million for Breonna Taylor, I think, came about because of pressure. I think the $27 million for George Floyd came about because of pressure. And I think the $20 million from Prince George's County fell in the middle because it was happening around the same time. And Prince George's County wanted to try to get out ahead of it, even though they were already behind, and try to dilute some of the media attention, which technically has happened on a national level. Like, people don't mention William Green being killed in the backseat of a police car in the suburbs of D.C. by a black officer, mind you, because it also doesn't fit the narrative. And, you know, that's part of some of the broader things we can think about. But this is the bottom line numbers. I'm throwing out all these numbers. This is the key number people need to know. If you look at the 20 major metropolitan areas around the country, over the past 5 years, taxpayers have spent over $2 billion in civil settlements for police misconduct. $2 billion.
It's an incredible figure.
It's an incredible number. Now, think about this. There are more misconduct settlements in rural areas and the suburbs of late, meaning there have been more police killings in the suburbs and rural areas than in some of these major metropolitan areas. So as large a number as that $2 billion is, it's astronomical across the country, and taxpayers are overwhelmingly paying it, because part of what happens, that $27 million doesn't deter it because police departments and police officers don't feel it. Due to qualified immunity, which is a court doctrine that prevents not only law enforcement, but government officials from facing any sort of civil culpability, meaning they don't have to take financial blame, that leads to that settlement money being put onto the general fund's budget. And what that means is that that means that money doesn't even come out of the police department budget. It's above and beyond that. So law enforcement doesn't like it doesn't impact them.
So let's pause over that, because this I think this is genuinely surprising. What you're saying is that qualified immunity protects the individual officer. So the individual officer is immune, assuming qualified immunity applies. So then, you know, if the city settles, why is that general money rather than, hey, the police department? I mean, if the Department of Public Works settles a lawsuit, is that the same, or is there something unique to the police departments that these giant settlements aren't touching their budgets?
I think it operates similarly.
It's just that the Department of Public Works doesn't kill people.
Exactly. Like they don't kill people. And if they did, overwhelmingly, it would have been an accident, or that individual person would have been able to be sued oftentimes if it's viewed as something that is overly criminal. And so it comes out of the general budget, because the assumption is that the budget is already set for the police. And similar to other social services, public works and what have you, they need that money for other sorts of things. Now, part of this is also the way that the Fraternal Order Police Union has been negotiating things. That is also part of the process here. But this money overwhelmingly comes from the general funds, unless two reasons that are very important for people to know. Like, it's spooky, and I write about this in the Lawfare piece. Like, it's spooky when people read it to be like, wow, that is wild. Unless it's a city or a municipality that actually does not have enough money to pay. What do they do? Well, they kind of have two options primarily. They can file for bankruptcy. That's happened in cities. Right. Like, for example, one of the most infamous examples to me is what's known as the Beatrice Six in Beatrice, Nebraska. Like, decades ago, they were accused of a heinous murder, and supposedly due to DNA, it got discovered that they didn't do it. It was men and women. They didn't do it. They got a huge settlement. The city, the small town of like probably less than 30,000, did not have the money to pay it. What did they do? They increased property taxes on every resident in the city, and they pay those people twice a year like people pay their property taxes. That you can have other examples. Neota, Tennessee, the same type of thing, but they had an insurance policy, which I'll get to in a second. Let me tell you about another example. Chicago, they have bonds. So when Chicago can't pay it, Chicago is a unique situation, partly because it's an extremely redlined city, it's highly segregated like other cities, but it has a history of this, so much so that Chicago appropriates funding in their budget for impeding police misconduct settlements. When Rahm Emanuel, the previous mayor, when he was there, they didn't have enough money in the budget. They had allocated some money, like $20 million. They didn't have enough money in the budget because that year they got $70 million. So what did they do? They took out bonds. Now people are charging residents of Chicago super high premiums and fees, super high interest rates and fees, in order to pay police misconduct bonds. Who ultimately gets hit with it? Well, it's like Inkster, Michigan, where when the taxes went up and they had to pay this huge settlement, what did they do? They actually closed the school system. They increased taxes. I mean, these are some of the wild outcomes that happen where a police officer does something to somebody and the schools close. I mean, like, what? I mean, that is so like heaven forbid that we actually fire the officer that did it or shrink or dissolve the police department. But instead, they remove kids from schools and send them to like the county school or something rather than having a city school system. Now, of course, there is an insurance model. And this is one of the big things that people have to realize about what I'm recommending here is that about 85% of law enforcement agencies police in areas that is well less than 30,000 people. Okay. What that means is they don't have the money to pay for things. Like, they're one lawsuit away. They're one slip. If a public works person didn't put down a sign that said it was a wet floor, they're one slip away from completely going bankrupt. So what do? They have insurance policies and they become part of an insurance pool, a risk pool. People are familiar with that.
With other counties and jurisdictions that are similarly small.
Exactly. With others that are similarly small. And when something happens, like what happened in Tennessee, like what happened in California, the insurance company comes and says, we can no longer fund you, and not just your police department, but your entire municipality. You have to do something with those officers. In Tennessee, they only had 3 cops in their department. They fired 2. In California, a small place outside of LA, they dissolved the entire department. That is the role that insurance plays. It leads to a level of accountability that currently does not exist for law enforcement.
All right, so let's talk about the 3 recommendations that you make. So the first is getting rid of qualified immunity. Now, this is, as we discussed on the podcast with Alex Reinert, probably not doable at the federal level, but it's being done at a bunch of states. So how does getting rid of qualified immunity, I suppose the most direct impact is that, you know, police officers would fear for their own pocketbooks, except that, you know, most of them would be indemnified by the terms of their employment anyway, assuming they weren't, you know, doing something really, really bad. So how does, explain how getting rid of qualified immunity creates an incentive for the departments to rein in out of control officers?
Mm-hmm. So qualified immunity, again, is this doctrine that applies to civil proceedings. The problem in law enforcement is that based on qualified immunity, oftentimes it's interpreted and applied to criminal proceedings. Like, there are some people who literally do not think that police officers should ever be convicted of a crime that was committed when they were on duty, particularly when it comes to use of force, protecting themselves or protecting other people. That's part of what Derek Chauvin's defense is trying to argue. They're trying to argue that because George Floyd's size, because of what he might have been on, because of this delirium narrative that likes to be pushed, that Derek Chauvin had to do what he did.
But is that a direct invocation of the qualified immunity doctrine, or is that just a kind of seepage of the idea that, hey, you know, cops have a hard job, you shouldn't convict a cop for doing his job just because somebody's dead? Like, is it a direct argument that he's immune from the criminal charge?
No, it's very much indirect. And I think that is the power of qualified immunity, is that everyone, the general public, which means jurors, judges, prosecutors, and defense attorneys, oftentimes apply qualified immunity in ways that the doctrine actually does not apply, but they still bring it into criminal proceedings, even if it seeps in. So it's not like it's direct. It's not like they're using that as a defense. Instead, what they're doing is they're talking around it. And if people, you know, when you watch this trial, you start to see that that's what the defense is trying to build up, that Derek Chauvin only had very few choices on what to do. Now, with that being said, addressing qualified immunity is big, and we're already starting to see some movement. Last year, the state of Colorado banned qualified immunity. New York City just recently chose to do away with it, which is fascinating. Even though the mayor, this is very confusing to me, the mayor said, yeah, but the officers aren't going to face any sort of financial responsibility for it. I was like, that's very strange. Now, at the federal level, I think at the time that the Lawfare qualified immunity piece was written, that was true. I think now there has been some shift, particularly with the Democrats winning Georgia and controlling the Senate, particularly if they do away with the filibuster for some of these things. And of course, I've argued about civil rights exceptions. I think this will be one. The George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which passed the House, includes a clause that absolves qualified immunity. If that legislation passes the Senate, then we will see something happen to qualified immunity at the federal level. I think that's one of the main things that the Republicans are fighting, however. And to your point, I think we'll continue to see a lot of movement at the local level. But addressing qualified immunity is huge because up to this point, law enforcement, and again, there's another stat that's important. well over 90% of the time, oftentimes 95% of the time, police officers are never charged or convicted of killing someone. And how much are we talking about? Pretty much every 20 hours. Like, there are well over 1,000 police killings in the United States every single year. Like, they don't really think about it like that. Like, they worry more about crashing their car than they do about the repercussions of potentially using their weapon. And that doesn't mean that they take that lightly. I mean, we have to be very clear that, you know, police officers, there are a lot who do show restraint at times where the law would actually allow them to use force, which is the reason why what Derek Chauvin did was so egregious. But addressing qualified immunity, absolving that, would be a huge step toward not only dealing with the financial side, but also enhancing transparency and accountability. Because when the Fraternal Order of Police Unions do these negotiations, they're negotiating a host of things that officers get the ability to do. Like, they don't have to give a statement initially. They can consult with their FOP rep. They can actually look at video. I mean, they get all these things that simply should not happen when somebody should be telling the truth about what they've done.
All right. So your second proposal is this idea that you've alluded to of departmental insurance policies that indemnify, that protect the department or pay out on behalf of the department. You've talked a little bit about this, but spell it out. How would that work? How would things in Minnesota and Minneapolis be different if the $27 million judgment were being paid by an insurance company on behalf of the police department?
Yeah, so using a police department insurance policy would mean that the premium for that insurance policy is paid out of the police department budget. The $27 million settlement that George Floyd's family received would come from the insurance policy. And then, of course, with something that large, we would expect the premium to increase. When the premium increases, that money should still come out of the police department budget. And it's important that the police department can't just simply increase their budget by 3 to 5% or whatever it might be to cover that. Instead, it needs to be capped and make them become more fiscally responsible with that budget. The other thing that happens is now, based on that increase, you can directly tie a police officer or group of officers to that premium increase. And when it's tied to the police budget, and all of a sudden the budget now has to take into account these payouts, not necessarily the general funds, it will lead to a level of accountability from the top down, where on one hand, it will give police chiefs the ability to justify, from a market-driven approach, the removal of bad apple officers. And then on the other hand, it will lead to other police officers holding each other accountable for what they do. Now, I think we're moving in that direction in some places, but depending on how that's going to roll out will dictate whether it will change something at all. Because if you simply create an insurance policy, but every time there is a payout and it increases, the municipality just lets the department increase their budget. Like, that doesn't really change a whole lot in the grand scheme.
Well, it ends up replicating the system we have now, except instead of subsidizing the police department's budget by paying a $27 million settlement out of the general fund, it subsidizes the police department's budget by paying the increased insurance fees, right?
Exactly. And this is where the insurance company comes into play. And these are some of the examples we've seen. That's similar to a person driving a vehicle, even though in this regard, and I'll get to the vehicle example, in this regard, what I'm proposing is more comparable to hospitals having insurance for people who perform activities in the hospital, surgeons, healthcare providers, and the like. Part of what happens is the insurance company will say, we can no longer insure you. Now it starts to make the department uninsurable. Or, like Neota, Tennessee, they will say, we will only insure you if you let these officers go, because they are costing us a boatload of money. That happens in healthcare when physicians keep messing up. The insurance company says, we can't fund this person to perform surgery there.
All right. So this is interesting, because this gets to an aspect of the incentives that is not strictly financial, right? So the general fund, when the general fund pays out the $27 million, it doesn't have the authority to turn around and say to the police department, you got to change the way you're behaving because this is getting too expensive. But the insurance company, which has the ability not to underwrite the department's policy at all, actually has the clout to make demands on the department's behavior. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair because see, part of what happens that the municipality oftentimes will try to make the department make changes. But part of what happens there is that if they fire an officer and then the officer is found not guilty in criminal proceedings, that officer can then sue the municipality, the department, for wrongful termination and back pay. We saw that there's a classic example that people probably know about a man who was killed in a hotel hallway where he wasn't armed at the time and an officer shot and killed him in the hallway as he was crying out, laying on the floor. And it was a white officer and a white person that he killed. And so in that regard, the officer was not found criminally liable. They had already fired him. They rehired him. This is in Mesa, Arizona, I believe. They rehired him. And then he retired to receive $2,500 a month in his pension and up to $3 million for a new defense if he needed and money for mental health anguish. Like those are the types of things that insurance companies oftentimes control a little bit better. And let me tell you why, because oftentimes they get out ahead of a lot of these things because they're saying like these, there are a lot of low level offenses. Like take Derek Chauvin. Again, he has 20 complaints. By the fifth or sixth one, the insurance company is like, whoa, this person's costing us a lot of money. 50 here, 150 there, 500,000 here. What is going on with him? We need to correct this. And if not, it's going to be a problem. We need to let him go. He would have been let go years ago had this been in place.
All right. Third and final recommendation involves individual officers carrying liability policies. So my question about this is, so under this scenario, who pays when there's a judgment against the officer? Is it the officer pays and the insurance company pays for him? Is that how it works?
So it's going to probably operate a couple of ways. I think most people will probably want it where the officer pays it. I think that will happen in some places, and that already does happen in some places. There will be other places where the municipality will cover the liability insurance for all of their officers. That will kind of be part of the hiring package, right? That will cover your insurance. I also think that this will be something that the Fraternal Order of Police will take up. And this is why I'm a big proponent of the individual officer liability insurance if it's in conjunction with the police department insurance. And I'll tell you why in a second. But overall, if it's on the individual officer, the Fraternal Order of Police will start to alter how it approaches its membership and how it thinks through things. And I think that will be a level of accountability. But one of the reasons why I think they need to go in tandem is this is why. Say Derek Chauvin had a liability insurance policy. Maybe it's $1 million. $1 million compared to $27 million. It still leaves the municipality to get sued because it's no way that $1 million is going to cover what he did. So unless it's in conjunction, that will happen. Not only that, it will lead to the municipality throwing the officers under a bus. Because again, I think about it like trickle down policing. Police killings is the pinnacle of it. The trickle down is the last time Derek Chauvin held down a teenager and put his knee on his neck and they got sued and had to pay out $150,000. His insurance policy covers that, right? Or would cover that. But part of what happens there is it will lead the department to simply removing the bad apples, which is a good thing, but it won't change the structure and the culture of the organization, which also has to happen. A police department insurance policy will help to change the structure and the culture of the department and not just allow them to keep cycling these so-called bad apples in and out.
All right, let's go to audience questions. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for being here, guys. So my question, have there been studies done of awarded settlements in police misconduct cases? And if so, what trends can be ascertained? I mean, you kind of touched on this already, but if you want to expand, please.
Yeah, I think the big takeaways are it's costing taxpayers a crap load of money. And it's costing taxpayers a crap load of money in ways that the money could be being used fiscally in different ways. And I think most Americans have no idea that their tax money is being used for this. And they particularly have no idea that the police department is completely absolved from these costs. I think those are the biggest takeaways. I mean, these settlements are starting to be astronomical. They're going to keep getting big. And the reason why it's important to note the big ones is because if these are the big ones, again, it's kind of the small ones that also add up as well. And I think that's the big thing. I mean, it's a lot of use of force incidents where someone is getting $40,000, $100,000, $200,000. Those add up. And I want people to think about this. As much as we care about our schools, our infrastructure, our healthcare, imagine that if that money went to those areas instead of these payouts.
The floor is yours.
Thank you, Dr. Ray. That's actually a good lead-in to sort of the ultimate point of my question. So I wanted to ask, sort of going back to the instigation of this civil suits against the police and the departments, for all of the cases that we've seen, you know, covered on cable news recently and, involving, I don't know what the word is, professional victim advocates like Benjamin Crump or Gloria Allred, there are these smaller cases that you just mentioned that don't get the same publicity and attention. So is there a sort of a correlation between these large payouts and the involvement of these high profile lawyers who have come with a full PR campaign and, you know, getting their press conferences covered live on the cable news shows? And how do we find a more of a balance between those cases that we don't read about on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post? And it's not to say that these lawyers are not doing their jobs and doing it well, but it's sort of how do we find more justice for those cases that are beyond the headlines that we see on, you know, national press?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Really good question. And I'll say that I correspond with Benjamin Crump and some of the other lawyers fairly regularly. And, you know, I think that they're doing a great job. And interesting, one of the things people have to note, and I really like how that question was phrased, because if people aren't paying attention, you would think that some of these lawyers were in the courtroom. Oftentimes, they're representing the families in the civilian settlement, right? And then, of course, they aim to apply pressure to aim to address a conviction. And so, I mean, of course, I mean, they get their normal fee, their normal percentage, which, you know, can be high depending on how it is. But oftentimes, families are hiring them for the PR as well. If some of these lawyers were not involved, some of these cases we wouldn't know about. I think George Floyd would probably still be one of those we would know about because we had that long video. But Breonna Taylor, we probably wouldn't. You know, Black women are much more likely to be killed in their homes than police than white women. There are a whole lot of them who we don't know. And that's part of what you're getting at. So I think part of what has to happen is, I think that what I've seen over the past year, there's been a scaling up of media and paying attention to these things, particularly in smaller markets. I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing is that when these incidents happen, there is a process that occurs locally where law enforcement, it's not really that they're always trying to cover it up like that. That's not exactly what's going on. But there is a process of there's due process that happens. And it oftentimes can last a very long time. If you want things to move quicker, then you oftentimes scale it up and you can get a local lawyer. Sure. And they're probably amazing. But if you get a higher profile lawyer, they're able to bring attention to it that speeds it up. I guarantee you that if we didn't have that video, not only would we not be talking about George Floyd, that settlement probably wouldn't have been as large and the case wouldn't have happened as quickly. So, you know, I think when it comes to highlighting some of the smaller ones, this is what I'll say. Washington Post, New York Times, The Guardian, they have some great databases. Campaign Zero has a great database of police killings. I advise people to look at that because, I mean, part of it, and I highlight this in the Lawfare article, that, yes, Black people are disproportionately more likely to be killed by the police. I mean, highlighting George Floyd, Black people are 3.5 times more likely than whites to be killed by police when they're not attacking or have a weapon. But just based on the sheer high percentage of white people in the United States, which is about 65%, in absolute numbers, there are more white people killed by police than black people. But part of what happens with the news is that the narrative is a white officer killing a black person, oftentimes a black man, like we saw with George Floyd. That's why that is so stereotypical of what plays out. When officers across racial groups and individuals across racial groups are being victimized by the police, and we need to also amplify those voices, because that's how we start to change it, right? Because there's some narrative out there that only black people are being killed by the police. We're disproportionately more likely to be killed, but a whole bunch of white people are being killed too. And I think once we start to change that narrative, I think we can really start to think of why it's important to change what's currently happening, because it's clear it's not working.
So let's talk about the role of police unions, which comes up in one of the questions that the questioner asked me to read. You know, there's a lot of sense that the Fraternal Order of Police is a real part of the problem here. And first of all, I'm curious to what extent you think that's fair. And secondly, how does the proposals that you've made, how does that interact with the political power of police unions in a lot of the jurisdictions that we're talking about?
Yeah, I think two things. I think first, I would say it's more than fair, the statement, and maybe even an understatement, that the Fraternal Order of Police plays a huge role here. Second thing is that how my research led me to thinking and interrogating police department insurance policies is because I was thinking a way of how to circumvent qualified immunity that the Fraternal Order Police simply does not want to give up. Now that it has failed on the big dog being NYPD, we're going to see a lot of things fall from there. Like I think it's going to start to fall fast, particularly like based on the Floyd settlement either way, but that's going to happen. But police department insurance policies will circumvent qualified immunity no matter what, because for me, it's not about solely the individual officer being held accountable. It's also about the organizational structure that he or she comes from being held accountable. What do I mean by that? Let's look at the role of FOP in Minneapolis. Not only do you have the president of FOP speaking at Trump presidential rallies, look, people have the right to vote and have whatever political preference they want. However, we have to ask ourselves, is that the role for law enforcement to be in that public way, right? Particularly given the fact that we know that in places where Trump campaigned at, hate crimes increased 200%. Like, we already know what's been happening just during COVID to Asian Americans and Asian immigrants in general. But in the FOP in Minneapolis, they were teaching this warrior style course that was still teaching chokeholds, that were teaching the sort of technique that Derek Chauvin put on George Floyd. And that's part of what we're going to hear from the police chief when he gets on the stand, which I think is going to be some very, very strong testimony. Because I'm going to tell you why. The current chief, and I might have mentioned this earlier, the current chief of Minneapolis was the head of internal affairs when Derek Chauvin received most of his complaints. He couldn't do anything about it. And so now currently you have the FOP president and the police chief, and this is the bottom line. Police chief is appointed by the mayor or county executive or whomever. The FOP president is voted on by the membership. And part of thinking about the individual liability insurance, I think what's going to happen is that the FOP could end up playing a role in this by helping to cover some of the liability cost. I could see them starting to negotiate with insurance policies. And I don't think that would be a bad idea, actually. I could see that happening because I think it would lead to more transparency. It would lead to more accountability. It would at least lead to people knowing more about it in terms of what's going on. And I think those insurance policies can help with that.
And it might lead to the FOP being a little bit more invested in cops behaving in fashions that don't generate liability.
Exactly.
Because right now they are essentially against officer discipline in virtually all situations. And that's partly because they're not paying for it.
You hit the nail on the head. And I think that is the point, is shifting. Like right now, funding for these settlements we're talking about are so out of whack. It's on the taxpayers. Nothing is on the police department. Nothing is on the officer. Nothing is on the FOP. What is stopping them from behaving that way? When that is coupled with the fact that, again, 90 to 95% of them never face any sort of charges for the brutality that they bestow on people. And again, here goes the stat. A person is killed by police every 20 hours. How often do you think someone is beaten up? How often do you think someone is stopped for no reason? How often do you think someone is put in handcuffs for no reason? How often do you think a police officer tells someone to F off? Like, probably every minute. And those are the things we have to change. They're not protecting and serving from an organizational standpoint. Unfortunately, at times they are terrorizing certain communities while simultaneously they are caring for other communities. And those differences have to do with race and class. And in 2021, when people think that supposedly we would get past this and having a President Obama will lead us to this holy grail of racial progressiveness, that simply hasn't happened. And we have to do something about it.
All right, we're going to wrap up shortly, but I want to ask you about the weight of the three proposals that you have relative to each other and relative to the criminal process. So, you know, we've got this $27 million payout that comes the week before Derek Chauvin goes on trial. Those two events are not unrelated to one another, of course. These ideas that you're talking about operate in tandem with one another. You know, reducing or eliminating the degree of immunity that cops have in civil cases, combined with an increased willingness to prosecute them, combined with a set of shifts in the financial responsibility associated with the settlements and the incentive structures those financial incentives create. Which ones are the ones that are the nibbles around the edges, and which ones are the ones that are going to do the heavy lifting? Like, if I told you you could have two of the three, I'm going to add heightened criminal scrutiny as a fourth, even though it's not really part of your set of proposals. You can have two of the four, but you can't have the other two. Where's the weight of the work going to be done in this?
Yeah, I think for the most change to happen, I put police department insurance policies number one. The reason why is because it changes the financial structure and it will change the way that accountability and transparency operates within departments. Second, I will put qualified immunity because I think addressing that will lead to a series of other policy changes. Now, with that being said, that doesn't mean that the individual liability insurance isn't useful. And I should also say that the police department insurance policy, I think, is high risk and high reward. And what do I mean by that? If it's done right, it's going to change a lot. If it's done wrong, it won't change a whole lot. But it'll seem like that it has been. The individual liability insurance, I think that's important as well. Like, people want to see just the officers held accountable. Again, the key issue there is if they only have $1 million policy, well, then what does that mean for the families who have lost someone? I mean, there's no amount of money that can replace them, but $1 million definitely doesn't do it. So then the municipality is still going to be hit with it. So I put the police department insurance policy there. We already have a model. Small municipalities already do it. We have a model in healthcare as well, and in practically all other professions where there's some type of blanket policy that exists. And then with qualified immunity, that really hits legislation. And that will lead to a change in policing as usual, as normal, and lead to a series of additional very high level, intricate legal changes that will make a huge difference in the ability for prosecutors to pursue police officers. Because again, we got to remember, over 90% of officers never face charges. In a lot of those cases, they shouldn't. Right? They actually shouldn't. But for the ones where they should, what would move that needle? And I think addressing qualified immunity would remove that needle, and the police department insurance would get them out of there.
We're going to leave it there. Rashawn, thanks so much for joining us today. And thanks for writing the piece.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and this show is a good example of why, when we have a Brookings scholar on, to talk about Brookings' work published on Lawfare. Our audio engineer this episode is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. You can get our merch at thelawfarestore.com, and you can sign up to join these Lawfare Live podcast tapings on our Patreon site. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, and as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.